Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce my friend, Stephen Machender, a great attorney, but also a fantastic violist, and his London Quintet. He's here to talk about lamentation and the limits of philosophy. This is the fourth or fifth in the series that we've done, that Steve has done over the last 5 or 6 years here, where he takes Mozart's music, explains the ideas behind it, and how that's expressed in music. They've all been fantastic, and we're here for another treat tonight. Thank you very much, Stephen.
So each of my four lectures so far, have focused on a different movement of a wonderful work, the G minor quintet by Mozart. And you're going to be hearing a selection from it tonight. I've chosen this work for several reasons. One, it's just one of the greatest works he ever wrote, and it has two violas. Mozart was a violist himself, and it's and he just wrote music that's wonderful to play. All violists love to play Mozart, and so this is a work that I've played at various times my whole life and have been curious about why it is so powerful and have tried to figure out how he communicates some very profound meanings that I've intuited, but lately I've come to understand that there are things that can be actually articulated about why this piece works. He wrote this piece in 1787, at just about the same time that he wrote a very famous letter to his father, and it's the most famous philosophical statement that's Mozart ever wrote, and it's cited in all of his biographies. Mozart was writing a letter to his father one day, and he suddenly received the news that his father was quite ill. And the tone of the letter suddenly changed, and he said, "I'm so upset to hear that you're ill, but just remember that death is the key to our happiness, and death is our best friend. It's very soothing and comforting." And at the same time, he was working on two quintets. Mozart liked to pair opposites. Philosophers might call this dialectics. On the one hand, he was working on a very brilliant, optimistic, upbeat work in C major, and at the same time, he was working on the deepest, darkest, most forlorn piece of music in G minor. As I became more familiar with the piece and what he was trying to communicate, it seemed to me that this piece actually contradicted everything he wrote to his father. And so that's been my quest for the past several years, trying to figure out what that was all about. And the way I've approached it is that I've discovered that Mozart is actually telling a story with this quintet. And you're not supposed to do that. The musicologists really look down on people who try to come up with stories about instrumental music. For many years, 100 years, there was this concept of absolute music. And this was like a truce between people who wrote program music, such as Wagner and Liszt, and people who wrote what was called absolute music, people like Brahms and Schumann. And they had this truce where people agreed that if music actually had an explicit program, like Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, which we've all seen in Fantasia and other places, that was okay to find a narrative. But if it was just instrumental music, that was not permitted. And that's how we were all taught in music school and music classes, that you don't do this. But in the past few decades, that prohibition has broken down, and musicologists have started to acknowledge that there were codes embedded in music that people use to communicate various emotions to people. Mozart was right in between writing his two greatest operas at the time he wrote this piece. He had just finished Don Giovanni, he had just finished The Marriage of Figaro, and had returned from Prague, where he had had a fantastic reception. And he had just been commissioned to write a new opera, which turned out to be Don Giovanni. And what we find is that there are passages in the first movement of the quintet that are previews of similar passages in Don Giovanni, and I discussed this about three lectures ago, but we find that the death scene in Don Giovanni has the exact same gestures, sequences, and harmonies as the death scene in the first movement of the quintet. So the story I've detected in this work begins with the fourth movement, the first movement, and it's the story of a hero. And it's the same story that Joseph Campbell wrote about in The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And we find this hero narrative in cultures from the beginning of time expressed most powerfully in the Greek tragedies, especially the epics of Homer. It's perfectly suited to the kind of form of music that was developed by Mozart and Haydn at this time, which we call sonata form. And in the first movement of this piece, there's a theme introduced, then there's a somewhat contrasting theme. The theme is the hero, and that first part is called the exposition, where we're introduced to the hero and his context and his society. The next section is called the development, where the hero goes on an adventure. He comes back from his quest with newfound wisdom, and in the first quintet, he then confronts his enemies and is killed. And Mozart depicts the hero's death followed by the ascension of the hero's soul to heaven. And that's the first movement. The second movement is, it's called a minuet, but it's really a confrontation between the hero and God, or some authority figure over the dispensation of his soul. Mozart depicts questions about justice and injustice to what extent fate can be overcome or influenced by beliefs and prayers. The third movement is that we come back to Earth, and in my last lecture I explained why I believe the third movement is a memorial service. It starts with a hymn, and then there's recollections of the hero. There's a section that corresponds perfectly to the funeral orations that became famous in ancient Greece, and actually also correspond perfectly to the Gettysburg Address, which was modeled on those orations. The third movement ends on a note of hope. It's in a major key, and you feel at the end of the third movement that you're finally having heard all these sentiments expressed about the hero's life, the hero's sacrifice, how we can gain inspiration from his example and move on to better things. All these platitudes that we always hear in funeral orations. This is the philosophy of the philosophical movement, and in fact, it corresponds pretty closely to what Mozart wrote in his letter. We can tell from Mozart's papers that he was indecisive about how he was going to end the work. He knew it was going to end fast because these pieces always end with the fast movement. And he started a rondo in a minor key, and then he decided that he wanted to end in a very happy, uplifting dance in a major key. And then he went back and he said, well, I just can't quite... didn't say this, but I'm imagining that he decided that you just can't go directly from the philosophy of the funeral oration directly to dancing and living. There has to be something in between. There has to be a time for grieving and lamentation. And so that's when he wrote this introduction to the fourth movement that we're going to focus on tonight, the lamentation movement. And how Mozart had this gift for understanding people and human needs. And I think what he's trying to t- tell us in this lamentation movement is that we have to make time for grief before we can continue our lives. And it just so happens that this was going to be my next lecture, and then George reminded me that that this is the 225th anniversary of Mozart's death. This very week, December 5th, Mozart died December 5th, 1791. So this is a milestone, and it's a time to grieve over our loss, over the tragedy of Mozart's early death at the age of 35. There have been many conspiracy theories about what killed Mozart. If you've seen Amadeus, that's the theory that Salieri conspired to kill him. And the reality is much more prosaic. He died either of kidney failure or a streptococcal infection. We want to think that when there are these great tragedies, there must be great explanations. That's why we have so many conspiracy theories over the Kennedy assassination. But to paraphrase Homer, sometimes history is just a bunch of stuff that happened. That's Homer Simpson. We'll get to the other Homer a little later. So it's appropriate tonight to lament Mozart's death. It also turns out tonight is the anniversary of the assassination of John Lennon, so that's another tragic day in the history of music. And today's also the 30th day after the recent presidential election. And I've been told that the Commonwealth Club is a nonpartisan organization, so I'm just going to say that some of us really experienced the election as a death, and we've been lamenting and just wondering, what do we do now that we feel so vulnerable to events that are now out of our control? So what I'd like to do before saying any more words is to give you a flavor of this piece. This introduction is just 38 measures long. It's 3.5 minutes, about the length of your average pop song. We're going to play just the first minute or so to give you a sense of what we're going to be talking about. Talk a little bit later about why we know this is a lamentation. Now that we've called it one, I think we all intuit what it is. But I will I'll address that question in just a minute. The questions I want to address tonight are what is lamentation and what's its relationship to philosophy? Why did Mozart insert a lamentation movement into this quintet? Why at this point? We've already addressed some of that. How do we know this is a lamentation? And what can this tell us about Mozart as a composer and as a philosopher? First, we'll define terms, as philosophers are supposed to do, right, George?
Right.
So lamentation is the expression of the emotion of grief or sorrow in the wake of a loss. It could be a loss of a loved one by death, or it can be loss of some other major aspect of one's life. And it's different from philosophy. It's almost the opposite of philosophy. Lamentation and philosophy both address the same questions. What is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of death? Why are we here? How can we go on knowing that we're going to die and all of our loved ones will die? That's really the crux of philosophy. That's what Socrates and Plato were trying to get at. And that's what Mozart was thinking about and writing about in his famous letter to his father. But they're different ways of dealing with it. They're almost the opposite. Philosophy is trying to address these questions through the use of reason. And lamentation is simply the emotions, the feeling of it, without trying to process it through the intellect. I looked up the Book of Lamentations. We're all familiar with the term. I wasn't really sure what it was, but it turns out that the Book of Lamentations is part of the Hebrew Bible. It was written in the wake of the Babylonian overthrow of the capital in Jerusalem of the Jewish people back in 586 BCE. And it was written in the wake of this tragedy, probably by someone in the who remained in the territory of Israel. I'll read a couple of a few lines from it. Here's an English translation from the Hebrew. How lonely sits the city, once great with people. She has become like a widow, she who was once great among the nations. A princess among the provinces, she is now in forced labor. Bitterly she weeps in the night, and her tears are upon her cheeks. There is no one to comfort her among all her lovers. All her friends have betrayed her. They have become her enemies. The foe has spread out his hand upon all her precious things, for she has seen nations coming into her sanctuary. Whom you commanded, they will not go into your assembly. All her people are groaning, seeking bread. They give their precious things for food to stay alive. Adonai, look at and pay attention, for I have become worthless. So you can see there are two different narrators. One is the third party describing this this wounded bride, and then the bride talks directly to God, asking why has this happened? And the thing I'd like to highlight, of course, is that the nation is portrayed metaphorically as an abandoned woman who's now helpless and vulnerable. And that seems to be a theme throughout Lamentations. It becomes a literary tradition. And if you go to the Iliad of Homer, the original Homer, ends with various laments by the bride, the mother, and the friend, female friend, Helen, of Hector, the Trojan hero, who was killed by Achilles. And the women grieve for their their lost hero, and they symbolize the city, which has also been conquered and is vulnerable. I'll read you a few lines from the lamentation of Hector's widow, whose name is Andromache. The family brought him, meaning Hector, into the palace and placed him on a large bed and put ritual singers around him to lead the dirge, and they chanted the song of sorrow. And cradling Hector's head, Andromache cried out, "My husband, you died so young and left me behind, a widow, with our beloved child, just a baby. And I doubt that he will ever become a man. Before that, Troy will be plundered and burned, because you are now dead, the one man who could have saved us." Thus she mourned, and the women joined her in her wailing. And then they have, immediately after that, Hector's mother laments, and she gives a similar lament. And then the narrator says, "Thus she lamented and stirred them," meaning the women, "to violent weeping." So this is in the ancient history considered the job of the women to mourn the hero after the funeral oration, which is the public ceremony performed by the men. And the modern example, the iconic widow that I would compare to Andromache, of course, would be Jackie Kennedy. And we haven't seen the movie yet. It's just come out. But that's an indelible image. Nobody remembers the speeches that were given at JFK's funeral, but everyone remembers Jackie with her black veil. And that's what we respond to on a visceral level. These and the young wife whose husband has been cut down and she's now vulnerable. In ancient Greece, when a hero died, there was first the formal funeral oration, and then there would be a private lamentation ceremony at the tomb of the hero. The lamentation was not only performed by women, but some women were actually hired to assist with the lamentation. They were professional mourners, and they would join in the chorus of the they would join in the lamentation of the widow who'd been who was mourning the hero. We come now to the how Mozart handled this, and whether he did it deliberately or intuitively, he decided to put a lamentation movement after the funeral oration movement. We know that he was familiar with Greek customs and tragedy. There was a Greek revival in Vienna and Germany and throughout Europe at exactly this time. There were many plays about the death of Socrates, and Mozart himself had only recently written an opera called Idomeneo, which is the Italian for Idomeneus, who is one of the comrades of Achilles in the Iliad. So he was very familiar with these things. It could be that he tracked it. It could be that he simply intuited it. The reason we can be confident that this is a lamentation starts with the clues that he gives us. The title of the movement is not lamentation. The title of the movement is adagio, which just means slow. But there are other markings. There's the key. He's returned to G minor, which is an unusual key for Mozart and for this period. Mozart wrote very few pieces in a minor key. And when he did, he usually had something special in mind. And it usually the key of G minor usually symbolized some kind of anguish or grief. The meter is 3/4, meaning three beats to a bar. The previous movement was four notes to a bar. And there's been a wonderful book by the late Berkeley professor Wendy Allenbrook, who analyzed tempos and meters in Mozart's operas, and she found that when it was a 4/4 movement, like a march, that tended to be more of a public type of, it would evoke a public ceremony, and when it was in a triple meter, like 3/4, it tended to be more personal, it was more like a dance, and would be more intimate, and that's borne out in this piece. So we have the public oration, it's in 4/4, and then we have the very personal private lamentation ceremony in 3/4. That's another clue. There's also a dynamic marking, and it's the dynamic is marked that it should be played very softly. In the previous movement, there were mutes on, which created kind of a distance. Now the mutes are off. There can be more of a raw emotion. And the theme of the movement is a descending five-note scaled down to G minor, which has a interesting resemblance to a couple of passages in an opera he wrote somewhat later, The Magic Flute. And The Magic Flute has two laments. One is by the Queen of the Night in the first act of The Magic Flute. Let's hear a little bit of the Queen of the Night's lament. Lament. That passage has many things in common with the passage in the introduction that we heard. It's in G minor. It has a descending scale down to G. It's soft. It's in 3-4. And I'll read you the words that she's singing. Console the deepest sorrow of a mother. In lonely grief I am forsaken. For my poor child no more I see. With her my happiness was taken. An evil fiend tore her from me. And if you've seen the opera, you know that she's referring to the abduction of her daughter, the Princess Pamina, by the evil Sarastro, who of course turns out to be a great sage, but we don't know that at this time. And so this is... And the Queen of the Night is not just a mother weeping for her child. She's a queen. She's the queen of the great realm of the night. So there's a political aspect to this as well, the same kind of duality that we find in the passage from the Iliad that we read earlier. Later, Pamina herself has a lament. She believes that her love, who she's followed to the land of Sarastro, his name is Tamino, has forsaken her because, as it turns out, he took a vow of silence in order to prove his worthiness to be entered into Sarastro's brotherhood of wise people, wise men, actually. But she feels that he's abandoned her, and so... I'll read you the passage, and then we'll hear how it sounds on strings. She sings, "Ah, I feel to grief and sadness, ever turned as love's delight. Gone forever, joy and gladness, in my heart reigns mournful night. See, Tamino, see my anguish, see my tears for you, my own. If for love you do not languish, peace I find then in death alone." And let's hear the music that Mozart puts to that, to those words. Passage is also in G minor. The Magic Flute is mostly in E flat major, which is the same key as the movement, the third movement of this quintet. But again, he goes to G minor for this lamentation. Again, it has the same descending diatonic phrase. Diatonic just means it's a regular scale, not a chromatic scale. It's in 3-4. It's soft. All the same characteristics as the earlier lament and of the introduction to the quintet. So that's kind of the methodology that I've been using to try to find the storyline. You just pair up instrumental passages with similar instrumental passages in his operas. And of course, Mozart would write music that had a narrative and dramatic aspect. He was right in the middle of writing the greatest dramatic operas ever written, and that's how his mind worked. And that's how, according to scientists, that's how our minds work. It's through the telling of stories. We actually perceive, there's been brain literature that theorizes that all of our perceptions ultimately come from little stories, and that's how we interact with the world. So I'd like to turn now to some of the other devices Mozart uses in this particular introduction to communicate the emotions that we feel when we hear it. Let's listen to, at the very beginning, the sobbing of the strings, this relentless pounding, which symbolizes perhaps the heartbeats and the slowing down of time, and the and underscores the loneliness of the grieving widow. We also heard repetitive eighth notes, but they were very fast and they symbolized the life of the hero. And now, and since then, every single movement of this work has gotten slower than the one before it. And now this is the slowest of all. The eighth notes symbolizing the sobs of the mourners. At the same time, the cello is playing plucked notes called pizzicati. They emphasize the minor key. It's just a very simple G minor arpeggio, but it has a special piercing feeling because of the because she's using her fingers to pluck the strings instead of the bow. Mozart had actually read Hamlet and written a letter to his father saying that he could have written it better than Shakespeare because he thought that the ghost scene was too long. And anyway, so we know he was familiar with Hamlet, and Hamlet was the play that talked about the slings and arrows of fortune. So let's hear the cello pizzicati. Pretty brutal, huh? Very simple. You can't argue with that. And then he evokes the echoing of the mourners, where, if you recall, in the Iliad, the widow would mourn, and it always ended, and then the rest of the mourners would follow with their grieving. And so Mozart has the first violin state the lament, and then the cello echoes it just the same way as they did it in the Iliad. It's hard to, I mean, people want to know, did Mozart really do this deliberately? And the answer is, who knows how Mozart's mind worked? He was one of the great geniuses. I've concluded that Mozart is underrated. Then, after this theme is stated, we come to the climax of the piece. You haven't heard this part before, but we have this extreme anguish, which is created through a big crescendo And at the same time as it's getting louder, there are descending chromatic scales that symbolize death. And we'll deconstruct that in a minute. But right now we're just going to play that passage for you. Point, I would like the cello to play her part and see if you can follow what's going on there. If you just follow the bottom notes of this passage, you'll hear what he's depicting. Now we're just going to hear the bottom notes. Mozart's audiences knew that's called a descending chromatic scale. Mozart's audiences knew that the descending chromatic scale symbolized death. The most famous, there are a couple famous examples. One is Dido's Lament, where again a woman grieves over the death of her lover and or the abandonment by her lover, and it's accompanied by repeated descending chromatic scales. In Bach, you'll find this repeatedly. The most famous example, perhaps, is in the B minor Mass. Bach depicts this moment with the moment of the death of Jesus with a descending chromatic scale. And throughout this quintet, whenever Mozart wants to comment on the death of the hero, or the fear of death, you'll find the descending chromatic scale. So he kind of buries that, but we feel it happening while the violin is expressing the anguish of the widowed bride. Then a few bars later, the theme returns, and we have kind of a very halting, tentative, vulnerable restatement of the original theme, the lament theme. And that's followed by some arpeggios, which are broken chords on what we call a diminished seventh, which is always used to communicate despair, anguish, and fear. So at this point, Mozart starts to transition to the next, to the upbeat allegro, and somehow he's got to get to G major after all of this. And so the cello drops out, and the mood lightens, and we have an almost dance-like figure in D major, which is the dominant of G major, and prepares us for the ultimate resolution into G major. So we'll hear the violin play that. That's how the introduction ends. And if you listen carefully, you'll realize that those last three notes are the original theme, descending diatonic scale, but in a major key. Now we're in G major. And the lamentation has ended, and we're ready for the dance. We're not going to play the dance. We're going to leave ourselves just grieving today. But now we're going to play the whole introduction. So by inserting this interlude of grief, Mozart has shown us that he knows the limits of philosophy. In the third movement, he evoked men speaking about grand things and abstract things, and abstract comforts that if we really thought about these things, we could understand intellectually why death is a wonderful thing. But Mozart knew that that was inadequate for human response to death. And he couldn't move on directly from that to a dance movement. He just had to put in something that would allow for the expression of grief. And he evoked the grief that a widow or a mother would feel after the death of a husband or son. And in this way, he's actually making a comment about philosophy itself. He's philosophizing about philosophy by trying to tell us how far you can take it and beyond which it's really not valuable to us. And he does this through his music in a piece of music that has no words but can communicate with us directly in a way that words are unable to do.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Stephen Bachner and the London Quintet playing Mozart's quintet and also speaking about the lamentation elements of it and the limits of philosophy. So I'd like to start with the question, which is, Steve, you know, I mean, our society tends to just ignore death or to try to pretend it doesn't exist or push it over to the side. Mozart's society and other societies where people didn't live as long, maybe on average, so on, had to deal with death a lot more often and took it a little bit more seriously and tried to deal with it in a different way. And I was just wondering if there's anything out there now where people are trying to find the beauty in, the beauty in the loss of beauty. Because you've lost a loved one, you've lost something very beautiful in life, and therefore that requires lamentation. But it doesn't seem to be part of our culture.
Well, in fact, the thing we hear the most about, at least in our local culture, is defeating death and never having to deal with it. And we've got people in Silicon Valley who are telling us that it's just a question of time before technology eliminates death. And maybe we can park our brains in the cloud and do all sorts of things and never have to deal with it. So I think we have lost something. And it's been pushed aside. In Mozart's time, it was an everyday event. Mozart himself had experienced the loss of one of his very closest friends just before he wrote this, who was 32 years old and was just about to join him in Vienna. He'd lost a young child. Mozart and his wife had 7 children. Only 2 survived beyond infancy. He had just heard that his father was seriously ill. And the culture was trying to come to terms with this from the point of philosophy. The Emperor Joseph II wanted a very rational approach to death. And he decreed that there should be no more coffins. That was a waste of material. And people should be sewn into linen bags and dumped into open pits. And that's the scene that we see in the movie Amadeus. It turns out there was such an outcry that he had to rescind that order and allow coffins again to be used. And he just said, okay, I give up. You guys are just too superstitious. This shouldn't matter, but I will go along with you. So public outcry changed that. So the movie is probably inaccurate. Mozart probably was buried in a coffin. So we don't have to lament that part.
All right. There's time for 4, 5, 6 questions. Who would like to ask the first question? Well, I'll take a show of hands. Before we finish tonight, who would like to hear the whole introduction played one more time? Anybody? Okay. Is it all right if we play it one more time? We'll do that the last thing. We'll do that last. We'll take a couple of questions first, and we'll leave the last 5 minutes for playing. So who would like to ask a question either about Mozart's life? Stephen, tell us a little bit about the book that you've written, because you've written a book on Mozart.
Well, I've written it and rewritten it, and I'm still working on it. Uh-huh. It's called Mozart the Philosopher, Death and the Key to Our Happiness. And I've taken what biographers have said about where the statement in the letter I referred to, where did that come from? And most of the biographers say that it came from Moses Mendelssohn, who had written a book about the death of Socrates, which was an updated version of Plato's death of Socrates. It's called the Phaedo. And Mozart had that in his library. And people say, well, this came from Moses Mendelssohn. So I actually track how did that book come into Mozart's possession, and what are the chances that he was actually a follower of Moses Mendelssohn, who is the grandfather of Felix Mendelssohn, and a revered Enlightenment philosopher and the founder of Reformed Judaism. Mozart was a Catholic. It's almost impossible that they ever met, and I really doubt he ever read that book. The other source is that people say is that it came from the Freemasons. Mozart was a member of the Freemasons, and they had an initiation ceremony that mimicked the death of a hero. And there were statements made that were exactly the same statements that Mozart wrote to his father. So I go into that quite a bit. And my conclusion is that Mozart, being the dramatist he was, and being conscious of what is the appropriate music or words for a particular occasion, drew upon these relatively common thoughts that were found in Mendelssohn, that were found in the Masons, and he wrote those right on the spot. They came to his mind. He thought that was an appropriate thing to say, but they don't get nearer to the depth of what he really felt and the issues that he was wrestling with. And he wrestled with them by writing the C major quintet and the G minor quintet and looking at both sides of it. And this G minor quintet is the quintet about death, and it just so happens to have this narrative that tracks very closely the epics of the ancient Greeks. So nobody has really noticed that, and so I thought it was worth putting into a book. I'm very grateful to my wife for putting up with the fact that I've wasted every vacation and weekend for the past 5 years trying to write this up. But she's been a really good sport.
Well, when Mozart was writing it, did his audience understand what we've been told tonight?
Mozart made a famous statement. It was about his piano concertos. And he said he liked to write for both the cognoscenti and for the masses. There was something that people could enjoy on the highest level, but there was also something that everyone could enjoy. And so there may have been people who understood this. Haydn probably understood what he was doing. I'm not sure who else. He tried to sell these quintets. He was always short of cash. He was not poor, but he had a very uneven income, and he decided that he really needed to live the same lifestyle as all the nobility who were his patrons. And he had his own horse. He had a beautiful apartment. He loved fancy clothes, and he always had trouble, especially right around this time, right after this, you find his letters begging his one particular fellow Mason for loans to keep him afloat. Some people think he may have had a gambling habit. He was an avid billiards player. In any event, he took these two quintets, which everyone acknowledges were among the greatest pieces of chamber music ever written. He took another wind serenade and arranged it for quintets. So he had a group of three. And he tried to sell it on subscription, and it was a complete failure. No one wanted to buy it. No one really understood what he was getting at. And his financial problems only got worse. So, no, people probably didn't get it. And even today, the word is semiotics. The musical semiotics means that there's a symbol that's supposed to refer to something else. And it takes the symbol, it takes the something else And it also takes an audience that understands it. One reason I do these lectures is to try to get people to understand what he's getting at and what these symbols might have meant at that time, so that we can appreciate the music. You don't need to know this to enjoy the music, but I find it really remarkable, the many layers of communication that he uses through these symbols. It's just amazing the degree of control he had over so many different aspects of composition. And that's one reason why we enjoy his music, even if we don't understand why.
Time for one more question before we listen.
thanks. What do you think this says, all this says about what Mozart thought the meaning of life and the meaning of death was?
I think it's mainly about acceptance of the world as it is. And there are a lot of elements to this, but I think ultimately it's grounded in people appreciating the sacrifices of others, being in touch with our own feelings of loss when death occurs, and then getting on with life. Mozart, to me, he reminds me of Voltaire in the sense that he could look at things almost like a naive and question and cut through the hypocrisies and the pretenses. And even no matter how absurd the situation in his operas, he always gets to the deepest, purest human emotion, whether it's laughter or manipulation or whatever. He gets to the core. So I think his philosophy of life was just get real. That would be his ultimate philosophy. All right, at George's request, we're going to play the introduction one time, and if we're lucky enough to be asked back, we'll play the happy last movement for you next time.
So 225 years after Mozart has died, we have this reminder both of the beauty that was, also a little lamentation for the beauty that was lost because he died early. But it's a nice balance in life. We've all lost something that's beautiful, but we all have things that are beautiful. We have to keep both of those things in mind. And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of Enlightened Discussion. Thank you very much for coming.